Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Golden Hour, a podcast that spotlights Asian creativity in music. I'm your host, Charlene Kay, and thank you, as always, for coming back. Today's episode features a musician I've been dying to tell you about. His name is Julian Saporiti, and he makes music under the name No No Boy.
Twice Southern with two civil wars. Fool to think that this place could ever be yours. The in-between, that's where we must explore. Tell Hanoi I love her.
Julian is half Vietnamese and calls his own music a Trojan horse for teaching Asian American history. And after listening to this episode, you'll understand why. I found out about No No Boy through my friend Deb, who is also our producer Dave Yim's wife. And No No Boy's album, 1975. This album is not only one of my favorite folk albums, it also happens to be the format in which Julian delivered his PhD dissertation at Brown University. That means, instead of delivering a 300-page thesis like most people do, his professor suggested he write an original album inspired by his research. That album, 1975, named for the year the Vietnam War ended, delves into the musical histories of Saigon rock and roll teenagers, Filipino cruise ship bands, punk rockers, church choirs in Chinatowns, and much, much more. The album ended up being a huge hit, getting praise from NPR, an American songwriter, who called his work insanely listenable and gorgeous. And I full-heartedly agree. Dave and I saw him play recently in New York, and it was an incredible concert. There was such a beautiful multimedia element where he was projecting archival footage on a projector in addition to triggering samples and playing with a full band. It was really unforgettable. And there were also fans there who had traveled to see his last three shows, which says something about the type of person he is and his fan base and how people just gravitate towards his music. No No Boy's song, The Best Goddamn Band in Wyoming, is about the little-known George Igawa Orchestra, a big band formed inside a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II. Here's a clip of that song.
Under machine guns, they dance behind barbed wire. At below zero, it meant something to sing. Angelinos mixing up with farm kids in the choir. The best goddamn band in Wyoming.
So, without further ado, please enjoy my interview with Julian Saporiti, a.k.a. No No Boy. Julian, hello. It is so, so wonderful to have you on the pod today. When you were growing up, what was one of your first experiences of listening to music and being like, holy shit?
All right. So it was my dad playing. My dad got like a reissued Dan Electro guitar when I was like maybe 10. And was just playing some like 12 bar blues on it. Those cute Dan Electros, there's like sparkly and stuff. Mm-hmm. I love them. And so that, like, just hearing my dad, like, right next, it's always when people are like, music is right in my face. You know, that's mm-hmm. when it's like, makes me feel like there's a God or something like that. And then.
And were you living in Nashville at the time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Born and raised, one of the few people you'll ever meet, born and raised in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And, shortly around that, like, floodgates opened. My best friend, Michael Fairhurst, he played electric guitar and he could play all the Nirvana songs. And I remember seeing, he was a seventh grader in the eighth grade rock ensemble at my mm-hmm. school called Three Guitar Attack. Maybe you've heard of them. TGA, Harding Academy, late 90s.
That's the best like name for a high school band.
Not even high school, middle school. These kids are ahead of their time.
Wow.
I remember it so vividly. And it was a music teacher's son sang, and then Michael played rhythm guitar. Jacob Goodman, who was a grade above us, played lead. Rob Bruneau played drums, and Turner Harrison played bass. And they played for the spring assembly in between like choir performances and the ska band, because we needed one of those. They played Today by the Smashing Pumpkins. And I remember just watching Michael, like one of my best friends, just down there on the gymnasium floor, just like wailing. And today has these awesome, very easy, but awesome drum fills, you know, ga, yeah. ga, 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 ba, da, 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 da. And then it goes into that chimey, pano, nano, nano, manano. So it's like all stuff eighth graders can play well. But just like the dynamics of that song, the loud, quiet, loud thing of that era, it just bowled me over to see like a kid that I literally had snacks with after school. Just like, I don't know if he commanded the audience, but he at least commanded me, you know, and that band did that for me. Yeah. And then I think that around that same era, the last thing that really blew my mind and encouraged me to be not just a musician, but like a sonic explorer was we were driving home from like one of the high school football games that like was just cool to go hang out at. And me and my friend Philip Brooks and his mom Wendy was driving us in the Mercedes station wagon, and we were dropping off some friends in West Nashville where I grew up, and probably on 102.9 The Buzz, Rage Against the Machine's Bulls on Parade came on, and I heard Tom Morello making his guitar sound like a DJ, and turntables were like really cool then. Mm-hmm. Like lots of bands, like Incubus just had a turntable player.
It's like, God, I love Incubus.
Oh, Brandon Boyd was a big crush. Big high school crush for me. And so there gets to this point in Bulls on Parade where it's like, wow, wicka, wow, wicka, wicka, you know, and Philip's like, that's a guitar, dude. I remember he said like the most profound thing, like he was teaching me, you know, he had already learned that they're seeing the music video. It's like, there's no DJ in this band. Mm-hmm. That's Tom Morello making his guitar sound like a record scratch. And I was just like, oh my God. And I wouldn't get out of the car. I wouldn't get out of the car until the song was done.
And
then I was like, well, I'm playing electric guitar and you know, music is my life. And, you know, and then some more like other kinds of music, but those were like, all around that 10-year-old era, I was just so ready for it. Then I just like took all of my dad's vinyl.
Yes.
I ended up working at a record store in high school. I was a journalist for the local newspaper just so I could get free CDs, like a much less sexy version of Almost Famous.
Yeah.
But I got to like interview awesome bands like The Strokes and Ben Queller and Def Cab and stuff like that.
Cool.
I was like 15, 16 years
old. Are those interviews like, still around? I want to read your interview with The Strokes.
No, this is like pre-internet, right? Barely.
Oh,
like pre like
God.
Digitized media. So like there are hard copy. I don't know if any of it's archived or anything like that. There was terrible writing. I just used the word incendiary like a lot. You know, it's like Audio Slave's new album. Chris Cornell screams the paint off walls and Tom Morello's incendiary guitar solos. Like, but
just a one trick pony.
And I just thought getting $20 for an album review plus the CD was like sick, you know? And I had this press badge where I could go to like any club in the city, which was wasted on me because I didn't drink alcohol as a kid. But it was irresponsible. It's like this 16-year-old kid just got my license and I'm out at like the Nashville scenes was at least terrible for like the headliners would not go on till 1 a.m. at like the two rock clubs we had when I was growing up. So I literally had to go before the headliners because I had a curfew, you know, my mom would be. So yeah, I had a very musical childhood. Not to mention my dad was in the music industry. So I like grew up on Music Row around all these country music stars and stuff.
Wait, tell me about your dad. What did he do in the music industry besides, was he
my
a musician?
My dad, Robert Charles Saporiti, good Italian-American and Scandinavian-American stock from Boston, real working class family from Dorchester. he was just a wild dude, still living in Nashville, kind of dropped out of college to be a folk singer, but realized that they were going to draft him to go to Vietnam. So he had to join the Navy so he wouldn't have to go in the Army. Did that, went to San Francisco, hung out with like all sorts of awesome people. Got stories about meeting Santana. Some of his best friends are in Creedence Clearwater. And he got really into radio promotion, was really good at it because he's a real gregarious dude. So he got a job in Nashville, was like the top independent promoter in country music in the early 1980s. Then his wife, my mom, got pregnant. So he took a job at Warner Brothers because the labels had been trying to hire him. And so I grew up like really just hanging out in the old Warner Brothers offices. My dad worked with like Emmylou Harris, Dwight Yoakam, Randy Travis, a lot of the like the new traditionalists, as they're called. He signed Faith Hill. He discovered Keith Urban, like all this crazy stuff. So,
wow. Well, you should know that my first ever song that I learned how to play on guitar before Blink-182 was Faith Hill's Breathe.
Oh, I remember seeing the like early returns on the music video for that. And my dad telling me how much it costs to fly her makeup person out to the desert to do her hair for that.
I watched that video recently, and I can see her frosted lips in my mind.
My mom, who can be pretty catty and wonderful, she's very French. I mean, she's Vietnamese, but we grew up very culturally French. And for someone who's never resided in France, she's very Parisian.
Oh my God, I can't wait for this shade.
She's super fancy. I remember her saying, maybe with a hint of jealousy in her voice, we saw Faith at the old Davis Kid bookstore in Nashville. And of course, like, she knew my mom because my dad had like signed her to Warner's, or so the story goes. And like, they said hi, and then my mom did this thing is like, not much without her makeup, huh? So that happened. And but yeah, wild like childhood growing up around country music stars, going to their ranches outside Nashville. You know, it was a time.
Yeah. Okay, so what was your pre No-No Boy musical life like? What were your projects like before?
Yeah, so I was in an indie rock band called The Young Republic, and we formed at Berklee College of Music in 2004, and it was great for a music student, because it was like a 10-person band at one point. It's very Bell and Sebastian, Arcade Fire, just whatever instruments you can find. And I was writing these little kind of indie rock / country tunes, being from Nashville, just filling them out with string quartets that were like, I could just learn about all these instruments. We had a flute player for some reason.
That's crazy. Because I was in a band called San Fermin for 5 years, which is also like, and it was an 8-piece indie rock baroque pop band that was always got compared to like Arcade Fire, because we had strings and horns and like 2 vocalists, and it was very bombastic. And
where were you based out of?
Here, Brooklyn.
Okay. So you moved to Brooklyn after for college or something? Or
no, I went to University of Michigan for college, and then I came here to play music, and I did my solo thing throughout. Mm-hmm. But I've been in a bunch of different bands since being here for the last 15 years.
I gotcha. Yeah. So similar situation. This band, we could only tour because we were college kids and just do the couch surfing thing.
Yep.
We were good enough to had enough money to buy a van, which was really cool. And like, put out records, and we got a record deal our sophomore year in Europe, not in the United States. So we had this experience of like getting to go to Europe and play like huge festivals, like Glastonbury Festival.
That is a huge achievement.
Yeah. Wow. I wish I hadn't been so young and like, it just completely wasted on me. And you also, again, I didn't drink back then, which is so terrible. You cannot go hang out 3 days at a music festival in soggy old England and not be stoned or drunk, because it is just like, it's like, now that I study them, it's like a refugee camp that people sign up for and pay like a crap ton of money. It's like the ultimate white privilege. I think I want to go like shit in the mud for, 3 days. And that sounds great.
No, and they love it. They love it.
Because like, if you're wasted,
get your wellies on. Yeah.
Because it's like, but I remember like a very vivid scene. Like our manager wanted us to play multiple shows at Glastonbury. And I don't think anyone who, could do anything for us actually saw us or anything, or the crowds weren't that great. But like, it was, we're like marching to this giant teepee or like big top tent for our last gig of 3 gigs that weekend. And I just remember it was like so rainy, and mud was like up to our calves, and we're in wellies, those like, plastic boots they wear over there.
Of course.
And I remember Beirut's playing like on the stage, and I'm like loving it, because Beirut's like my favorite. Keep going, man. Keep going. We gotta get to the gig. We're using our like guitars as like the shields from the rain. Mm-hmm. Someone loses a welly. It's like, keep going. No, we can't go back for it. Just go. And meanwhile, like Beirut's, doing his thing.
The French horns are blasting.
The French horns are blasting. It's in the rain. Like, we're losing wellies left and right. And then we go play
losing
in the middle of a teepee in the, with all these drunk English people. It's beautiful. But
what a way to cut your teeth. Yes. And so tell me how that segued into realizing No-No Boy.
Well, I retired. I retired from music completely. I was about 27. The band, The Young Republic, had put out a couple good records, one record called Balletesque, which is not online anywhere. And I had to like buy it secondhand on vinyl somewhere. Mm-hmm. But I love that record, because we got a bunch of money from the recording company, and we built a studio. So we were able to make all these great records and stuff that no one heard. But I retired because I was just really burnt out from being on the road. And I wasn't much fun. I've always had terrible social anxiety, but never like diagnosed, because I've always been also like, when I'm in the center of something, I'm a very charismatic, gregarious person. But as soon as I'm outside of that, like off stage, I just freak out. Like I have a very hard time dealing with people and stuff like that. But because you are a gregarious person, a lot of people never realize that around you.
Yeah.
And then you can get into, you know, all that kind of stuff. Just life is very difficult emotionally and things like that. So I needed a break from touring. I just wanted to go somewhere where I wouldn't have to play music, which sounds very sad thinking back on it, because I love music so much. But I wanted to read some books. And because I'd gone to music college, and in high school, mm-hmm. all I did was listen to records. So I literally did not read a full book my entire high school experience. So I made friends with this professor back home in Nashville, where I was kind of bumming around living out of the recording studio we had built. And he taught, or he teaches at a place called Vanderbilt, this history professor. And he was just like, come see me in my office hours. And I ended up going to his office hours like every week at Vanderbilt just to shoot the shit. He was a fan of my band. He gave me one of his books, studies French history. And then he was like, why don't you just like take some classes here? It's like, don't pay for them and everything. I'll talk to the teachers. And so I just vagabonded at Vanderbilt and kind of filled in my undergraduate education, philosophy, history courses, French class, all this kind of like very, you know, classic education stuff. And I really dug it. And then he's like, hey, what do you think about grad school? And no one in my family has a graduate degree. Maybe some back in Vietnam, like way back, there was a doctor, I think, but none of my American family had, well, no one on my dad's side had got a college degree actually. So it wasn't like really in our family. So he told me about grad school, and I applied to this place that had a terminal master's program in Wyoming, the only university in the state, University of Wyoming, because they would actually give master's students, teaching assistantships. So I would get paid to go there. Mm. And I was like, that sounds great. And since I was like a broke ass musician, like getting $12,000 to live off plus student healthcare, I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like I hit the jackpot, which is really sad to hear myself say back, because that I think is below the poverty line.
Yeah.
but rent in Laramie, Wyoming was like $300 a month for like a little basement I shared with two other kids. And I just read books and I climbed rocks for 2-3 years of my life and just educated myself like spiritually, obviously in a more traditional way, physically, got my body strong for the first time because I had just been a musician for most of my young adulthood. So
yeah, wasn't just much a doughy musician.
Of. Yeah. A little scrawny. But along the way, not wanting to like have a music career again, not even thinking about it, not wanting to have any kind of career, just kind of happy to be there. My teachers would say, well, there's some cool history spots when you're going out climbing. You know, when you're going out towards Idaho, Utah way, stop on I-80 at this place called Rock Springs, very important Asian American historical place. And so I did that on a rock climbing trip, kind of made this pilgrimage to this spot where in 1885, 28 Chinese miners were massacred. And like there was in many Western towns, most Western towns, there was a Chinatown, but that got razed to the ground, just burned to the ground. And I remember just sitting there and really just feeling all that history in that moment. As one of the few Asian Americans in Wyoming, I kind of felt a kinship to knowing that there was a whole community of them. And then from there, I drove north, right outside Yellowstone National Park, to this place called Heart Mountain, which was once the third largest city in Wyoming during the war. It was an old Japanese incarceration camp. And I saw this picture of this jazz band that I wrote this song about that now lots of people have heard, which is so cool. Get some like kind of secret teaching happening. Mm-hmm. And like knowing that not only, again, was this huge population of dark-haired, slanty-eyed people like me, being able to see pictures of them, knowing that they were, you know, unfortunately for them, Wyomingites. I chose to become a Wyomingite. They were incarcerated there. But nonetheless, it like kind of gave me a lineage, especially seeing the musicians. Cause I was like, right. Like, it did so much for me, because if you're being rounded up because of your race, your ancestry, your blood sucks. And put into these concentration camps, not like the German ones, but like low-key concentration camps, like barbed wire, machine guns pointed in, like, but you still form a band. It's like, those are my people. That's the history I want to learn. And this is a history I want to tell people, you know, because Absolutely. Like going to Berklee, fine music college, but I never studied any Asian American or any Asian musicians in pop music. And there have been tons. Like, jazz has been in Asia since the Americans, you know, who were stationed in the Philippines brought it over. You know, we're talking like turn of the century, like, you know, and that spread through these incredible kind of chameleonic Filipino musicians to parts of Asia, from South Asia to East Asia, everywhere in between. They're playing cruise ships, you know, in the 20s and 30s and spreading American popular music. So it was through, honestly, like, just, I joke because like going to Wyoming, that's where I became Asian American, which is kind of ironic since there's so few of us who live there. Yeah, and, but yeah, that history, it was that gateway through those musicians into this Asian American history. I was like, oh, this land, not just from an Asian American perspective, out West anywhere, has so many different like layers of overlapping histories, you know, whether it's the ecological history, which has always been there and evolved, or the native history, Black, Latin America, Asian American, whatever it is, you know. And that's what wanted to study. So eventually I had to leave my beloved Wyoming because I didn't have a PhD program. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to get a PhD, because when I was teaching at Wyoming, someone said, you'll get paid more if you get a PhD. So they told me what it was. And then I applied to programs, ended up in Providence, Rhode Island at Brown University. And then I started No No Boy. I basically had done all this research starting from 2012. And by 2016, I remember I was at an academic conference and looking out at the crowd, delivering a paper on the Georgie Gawa Orchestra, this jazz band that formed at Heart Mountain. And there was like maybe 20 people there, which is a fantastic audience for an academic paper. Usually it's like three or something. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking, oh man, what if I had this story to tell when I was like playing Glastonbury? You know,
yeah.
I actually like have something to say now. And I went home and I had all these interviews, just sort of just whatever I was interested in Asian Americas, like whether it's old internment camps or Chinese populations in New York, or like my own Vietnamese history. I had like recorded an interview with Michelle from Japanese Breakfast before she blew up. And I was like transcribing all these kind of like all these layers of Asian American history and like kind of sort of Asian American musical practices as well, sort of like uncovering this. And one, I remember I was back home. One of the last times I was home in Nashville, because my mom moved to Portland a few years ago, so we don't have that home anymore. But I was sitting down in the dining room and she was cooking some cha yao. It's like really good. I don't pronounce it right, but it's like really good little Vietnamese fried spring rolls. And I love that smell, the greasy, oily smell and the fish sauce. And I was had these headphones on and just like all these voices. I was just transcribing the way that grad students do. But I also had my guitar next to me. So whether it was like Michelle Zauner's voice or people had lived through these internment camps or talking to my own mom, I just started turning their literal oral histories and interviews that became the lyrics of the first batch of No No Boy songs.
Wow.
And I went back to Providence and I had like 12 songs and I put on a concert, and this OG Asian American movement, Asian American studies guy, Bob Lee, who became my advisor, he was at that concert, this little art gallery in West Providence. And he was like, why don't you do this for your dissertation? Why don't you sing your dissertation? I was like, oh, because no, I don't think you're allowed to. That's why, Bob, you know, but we did it. You know, I just handed it in earlier this year. And half of it is documentaries and an album that I just put out. And so that's kind of how No No Boy came about. It's like not trying. I still don't use a manager or an agent. I only do gigs when I'm invited to do them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's very nice because a lot of times they're university gigs, so they'll pay the bills. But yeah, it's just really, you know, just totally give up, keep playing music, and then like good things happen.
Your music has been called a Trojan horse for teaching Asian American history because you're pulling people in with these beautiful folk songs and really dynamic music videos, but you're also schooling them on the inequality and racism and oppression of Asian American and indigenous folks. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners where the actual term No No Boy comes from and explain a little bit about how you happened upon that.
Yeah. That's another history lesson, because I knew if the music did okay, people would Google that. And hopefully for the foreseeable future, there's always going to be a great Asian American novel That was written a long time ago. So it's not without its problems, particularly concerning gender and stuff like that. But anything written in the 50s is probably going to be. But Nona Boy, John Okada, one of the great Asian American novels, one of the first Asian American novels, really gets at, you know, it talks about this history, this larger history that the Nona Boy term comes from, which is, to be short about it, in the camps, people were given this loyalty questionnaire and asked if they would serve their country and forswear allegiance to Japan. And a lot of people, about, you know, I don't know, 10 to 20,000 at the end of the day said no and no, or some sort of negative answer to that. So they were put into this, basically what became a maximum security segregation center in Tule Lake. So it's kind of paying tribute to a hidden history inside a hidden history with the Nono Boys. But I just love that book. I love that book, which talks about like a post-war Nono Boy coming out of a federal prison, draft resistor, and just is like really shunned by his community, which is something a lot of Japanese Americans did to their fellow Japanese Americans who were no-nos, which is so crazy and messed up. And now they're sort of like reclaiming it as like early, like proto protesters kind of thing. It's much more complicated than that. But at the end of the day, this book, I really love assigning when I teach. I love when people read, and I know a couple dozen people have read it now because of the band name, which is sick. But it's just, it gets at this thing about really being kind of torn in two, like being, feeling bifurcated, like being cut in half on like a soul level that I think a lot of immigrant kids feel. And Okada does that in a really devastating way. And I think the invisibility of his work, basically up until recently, or at least till some Asian American writer bros rediscovered it, like in the 70s, I think, like he died, you know, kind of nameless, as far as literary giants go. And so, yeah, it's just everything I do, it's a chance to sneak some of that research, that teaching into the music, the Trojan Horse mm-hmm. thing. And so mm-hmm. why not start with the band name? Also, there's this Japanese band called The Spiders who have a song called Nono Boy. It's one of my favorite songs ever. They're like this like Beatles ripoff band, like they head all over the world and they look so freaking goofy, like in the early 60s when they're like kind of mm-hmm. doing their Mick Jagger ripoff kind mm-hmm. of stuff. But like they settle into a really good band and they wrote this beautiful song called Nono Boy. It's just absolutely gorgeous. So yeah, if people look up The Spiders or John Okada because of the band name, I think that's great.
So much of why I started this podcast was to fight for our visibility as musicians, as Asian Americans. And I really resonate with your story going on that hike and feeling the history of what happened in that place in Wyoming and mm-hmm. feeling those ghosts kind of move through you to push you towards actualizing yourself and your identity and becoming more connected with your heritage in this way. And I think that there's such one of the biggest motivating factors in my work is fighting this sense of an invisibility that I've felt when I was growing up in Arizona, one of the only Asian kids, a primarily all white high school and community, feeling like I wanted to assimilate and also feeling that pressure from my parents who were immigrants to assimilate, to survive.
Where'd they immigrate from?
Singapore.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. My mom grew up as one of eight kids. Her mom worked as a maid for a wealthier family. Her mm-hmm. dad left when she was really young. And so she definitely has this scarcity mindset of you must survive, you must provide for yourself. It's really risky to be an artist. And I feel like in choosing the name Nono Boy and resonating with that, it almost feels like you're identifying with this sense of like, you know, not being agreeable, not saying yes and agreeing to serve something that doesn't feel true to you, something that isn't right, something that goes against the grain of oppression and capitalism and imperialism. Mm-hmm. And I really feel that in your music. And I think that it's important too.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I think that, you know, I was very lucky because I did come from an artistic family. My mom is a painter, fashion designer. And obviously my dad worked in the music industry. So there was like the weirdest thing I've ever done is get a PhD. Like that's the weirdest thing in my family that I could have done. My dad still doesn't really know what it is, but he's gosh darn proud of it.
Oh my gosh. If I got a PhD, my mom would be like, you're good. We're good. Yeah. We're good now.
Yeah, we're good now. Yeah, I find that really, really tough. But you know, what's interesting to me is like, I grew up in a similar situation. It was sort of a black white binary in my high school. It wasn't all white kids. But I really didn't know where to fit in. I remember talking to a friend, what was her name? Like Sakuria. She was my French partner. I was telling her like, yeah, I mean, I know y'all got like a lot of like all this, like I was in high school, so I didn't know much, but I was like, we're in a humanities class. And I think we were talking about blackness and stuff like that. It's pretty woke teacher for early 2000s. And I was talking to Sakuria, who was a friend of mine, who I considered a friend, and just talking about like, well, at least you got all these kids at the lunch table to sit with, you know, mm-hmm. it's a black girl. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I just feel like I got no one. I feel like there's just no one at school who like, I can't just like, because it was made a big deal about like the black kids sit with the black kids, white kids sit with the white kids. And I would kind of just like go between. And yeah, that idea has really resonated with me. Even now, when I get to come talk to folks like you and connect with other quote unquote Asian Americans, I still never get the East Coast or West Coast Asian American vibe that so much of our literature and our I think our representation comes out of. I think maybe part of that is because I'm not East Asian, which is sort of the dominant culture of mm-hmm. Asian America. Like, yeah. Or the more educated and richer cultures of Asian America.
As Ali Wong says, they're fancy Asians and jungle Asians.
Absolutely. I'm very much a jungle Asian, but I'm a Tennessee Asian more than mm-hmm. anything else, you know, and I'm a musician before I'm any kind of identity, gender or race and stuff like that. So that's why I gravitate towards history and people who have lived in the same place I'm living. Like Asians in Wyoming are interesting to me because I know we both know what the sagebrush looks like, you know, and we, you know, those musicians in the band, we know what it's like to tour around and play jazz music. They mm-hmm. had to go back to a concentration camp. I did not, but I know what it's like to take a band around a cold, you know, negative 20 degree like Wyoming during the winter and like feel the warmth in the mess halls or the Elks lodges or the church basements or wherever you can find a gig out there. So I still don't feel, even though this work has been embraced by a lot of Asian Americans, like it's sick. Like I played a show in Portland the other night. It's like the first post-pandemic No-No Voice show here. And we had all these Vietnamese people come out. So we got a pretty good Viet population. And they were like, can we hang out? Can we get pho and stuff like that? And I'm like, yes. But the thing is, like, I hadn't met any Vietnamese people hardly at all till I went to Brown. Like, and I remember when I got to Brown, I asked every single kid I met, like, can we get pho? Like, can we hang out? Like, I want to know because I'm such mm-hmm. an island Asian growing up in Tennessee. But I realized looking at the demographics recently, like, that's most of us. Most of us, there's a bigger percentage that live in the South and the Midwest than there are on either coast. And I'm kind of interested in those stories. Like, I was talking to someone the other day, like a literary person. They're like, oh, you should turn some of these songs into like a book or something. I was like, oh, okay.
You're like, I turned the book into my
musical
dissertation.
So I was talking to this person and I was very flattered that they would think that. And I was just saying, but yeah, if I wrote something, I feel like there's people like Michelle Zauner, have this like really, great voice, like communal voice that's been articulating the last 10 years. Like whenever you go to a bookstore, it's a lot of times these incredibly smart, MFA educated, a lot of East Asian women writing these incredible books, incredible fiction, incredible nonfiction. But I sort of am like, where is the Tennessee bro Asian book? Mm-hmm. You know, where's that like just sort of ne'er-do-well vagabond roaming around Asian? Because that's like, that's what I'm about these days. So a lot of what I'm interested in is that continuing like how this started, like road tripping, like have some mm-hmm. great plans for this mm-hmm. summer for like historical sites to visit to then turn mm-hmm. into music and songs and stuff. And try to share these like new histories that some of my colleagues are just digging up, like about how Oregon, the first people to ever discover Oregon, we got to go all the way back to 1603 for the first non-native people who ever saw Oregon. It was a Spanish ship that set out from Acapulco, but there were 7 Asian folks on that ship and 3 enslaved Africans. So the first people to discover Oregon, you know, was it like some Indian dudes, some Japanese dudes, some Filipinos, like, and that story has never been told before. Like it literally was just discovered by my friend Diego, fellow PhD at Brown with me. And like, so going to that site, making pilgrimages to these places, turning that into songs. And I think about like oh, well, what can that do if I end up writing a decent song about it? Like, and I can go around and play it in Oregon. It totally upends like a state that was formed in the mid 1800s with a literal white supremacist constitution, a whites only constitution, like so much of the West, a place that was massacring Chinese, like back in Wyoming as well. Mm-hmm. You know, a place that there were race riots and the Klan had a stronghold in, a place that is a center of white American manifest destiny iconography with Lewis and Clark and the Oregon Trail. What does it do that in 1603, two full centuries before Lewis and motherfucking Clark came out west, God bless them, there was these Asian bros like looking out and seeing Oregon, right?
Yeah.
Like that's mind blowing. It totally like makes you rethink the history, because like that's before those Chinese miners and railroad workers, it's for the Japanese plantation workers. And it really opens their eyes. So I'm so stoked on how like that process can continue. In those
and how
voices.
You're able to continue their legacy.
Yeah, well, just have a legacy at all. Because like I said, if it wasn't for Diego, my buddy, finding this in like some ship's manifest from 1603, we wouldn't know that there was South Asian bros seeing Oregon in a snowstorm in January on January 3rd for the first time, you know? And man.
Can you talk about your personal relationship with the Asian community through your work and how that's evolved as Nona Boy has evolved?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this wasn't really started to reach the Asian American community. I'm glad it does sometimes when we're on the East or West Coast or the odd Asian who lives out in the middle of the country. But I thought about it living in Wyoming and my students and my friends who are out there and just being able to like, okay, I can't lecture anyone about immigration history without possibly getting into a fight these days. You know what I mean? Which sucks when you're a red stater like myself. But what I can do is trick y'all and sing some catchy folk songs. And then, what was that song about? And I've literally had people, you know, write me emails, you know, and from Billings, Montana, or like people from Wyoming, like ranchers or miners, like take me out for a drink. And we kind of talk and open some of those conversations. That was the intended audience. You know, these days, like I said, I don't do this concert very often because it is very heavy, because I don't want to cry all the time. You know, I think part of what I hope I can do, whether it's for like my academic colleagues who might work out of what I do, or whether it's for like other musicians or just like kids growing up, you know, trying to figure some stuff out. I hope that these stories and these songs and these histories, not so much like me as a representative, but like as a messenger of these histories, helps to ground what seems to be a really interesting and increasingly strong, quote unquote, Asian American movement with some more of its history and a more diverse history than we get. Mm-hmm. That's like, you realize that, okay, yeah, if you start with the borders of the United States, it starts with the Chinese and the 1800s and stuff. But if you go back to what was actually happening across the Pacific with the Spanish and stuff like that, you've got Japanese populations in Mexico. You've got like Chinese barbers in Mexico City. You've got hundreds of thousands of folks in the Caribbean mixing and blending and stuff like that. Chinos all over the continent. So trying to diversify and like kind of, I don't know, just provide more than just a generic kind of cross Pacific stories that we have of Asian America. So that's like one thing I'd be happy to do, is just like a little more history, right? And a little more complicated history, like, you know, and also to unpack these ideas of immigrants and refugees, to not flatten them, is very important to me. So I write a whole song about like the boat people. That's just about one person. So you get more of a three-dimensional view of that. Because all those people were just one person. There was a million of them.
And that's the best kind of songwriting, right? It's specific. It's not.
It's a songwriting I like. It's a world building method. You know,
it's very like, personal.
Yeah. When I was a kid, and like those Bell and Sebastian records would really illuminate my idea of Glasgow, Scotland, just through like, you know, these different characters, Lazy Line Painter, Jane, or something like that. But yeah, as far as the Asian American community, I really don't know. I feel less Asian now than I did when I started this project, actually. Like, I don't really identify. My identity has come back to being a musician, first and foremost, because that's when I feel, much like climbing mountains, that's when I feel the presence of, I don't know, Buddha or whatever I believe in these days. And it's through community and connection that I really, I don't know, just feel good. And that's what I'm looking for. I realize how I look. I realize the subject matter I sing about, but I'm more questioning, and this is probably the PhD side of the idea of Asian America to begin with, and who we include and who we don't include, and what voices represent us. Again, like I love the Asian American Month selection at Powell's Books, best bookstore in the world here in Portland. But again, it's a lot of like East Asian women from MFA programs who kind of all forefront their trauma. And my friend Dao Strom, who's a sick Vietnamese American poet, she was telling me the other day, she was like, you ever think about how like Asians are kind of basic? We just talk about food and trauma all the time. I was like,
not untrue. Not
shots
untrue.
Fired. And Dao is awesome. Like she leads like a Vietnamese like female like poet collective. So like she's the real deal. But I think she's also a little older than me. So maybe she's just not, you know, like as scared of the children as I am, being generationally adjacent. But yep. I was like, yeah. And I don't want to tell those stories. Like I do a little bit, like involved mm-hmm. in our history is the trauma. But yeah. I kind of feel like, you know, there's that term inherited trauma, right? And that's huge in academia. I think it's huge beyond it at this point. But the thing about an inheritance, right? You can, once you realize you have it, you can give that money away. And yeah. I feel like that's something we get stuck on a little bit. Mm. It's like, okay, I've dealt with this trauma my mom actually went through, right? Like the bombs going off, like the real trauma. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that difficulty with identity, Lord knows I have it, beaten up on the playground, cursed out, all this kind of AAPI hate stuff. I'm all for supporting.
It doesn't invalidate that. Yeah.
No. But do I want to live a joyless, inherited trauma-controlled life? Absolutely not at this point. And I think those are more of the voices I want to hear. I want books that just like are celebratory and full of imagination and taking like magical realism and doing something with it. And I want songs that do that. And that's who I want to see. That's my representatives, because those are the bands that I studied, whether it's that George Egawa band. They're making magic behind barbed wire. Mm-hmm. They're not singing about being behind barbed wire. You know, they're providing relief. And that is a bravery that I want to get to. And if I'm already at a much more privileged state, whether it's economically or not behind a frickin' barbed wire fence, I want to bring more joy. But for us, I don't know. That's the kind of Asian American movement, or at least branch of it, that I want to find and connect with. I want this like joy filled thing. I want this like kind of like empowerment through joy mm-hmm. while not negating what I said, learning our actual history, not just bold letter words, not just a few dates here and there, but digging into your family history, seeing what it was really like, seeing all the complications, problems, nuances of it, and sort of expanding who we include in this conversation. Then I'm probably more down for the Asian American movement, I think. But
does that mean No Boy disco album is on its way?
It's funny. I was just, I'm scoring a film right now. And one of the tracks is a disco
really?
Track.
Yeah, wait, what kind of film?
I don't think I could tell you. I'm pretty sure the contract I signed I can't tell you, but it should be cool.
Well,
it's a Vietnamese American story. And if they end up making it, it'll be like an actual, like, you know, Hollywood film about a Vietnamese American person, which I'm very stoked about.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Here's to joy. Yeah. Disco. I mean, like we're putting a lot more, my fiance plays drum machine when she's not in law school, and kind of uses all the samples I collect from all these historical sites. And we try to have it be a little more upbeat and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Julian's fiance Amelia is also in his band, and it's a beautiful collaboration. Feels so fitting for both of them to be singing and playing this music and performing it together.
Yeah. She's the best.
So you have two No No Boy albums. You have 1942 and 1975.
Yes.
What's next for the project? And this is a two-part question. In writing all this history woven into your music, do you ever feel the impulse to return to what's going on personally with you that's outside of a historical, political, sociological context?
Yeah.
And would that be a different project, or would that still be No No Boy?
No, I have a different project. We just, we have a band called Little Monk Panda Scout, me and Amelia, which is just all the love songs we write for each other and silly songs. It's like a pandemic love song project.
I love it so much.
Songs we courted while I was on tour. We first, we're friends for a long time because she was like an undergrad at Brown. I had absolutely no desire to get into that. But then she grew up, which is great. I think we're probably about the same maturity level anyways.
Yeah.
But like, we fell in love writing letters and writing songs to each other. And, you know, it was about the time we were both ready to leave Brown. We haven't been apart since, and we're getting married this year. And so we got that band and we play out, and that's really fun. And I hope we can do more of that. But as far as the No Boy stuff, that's going to be rooted in history. I mean, I see, like, you have to know your history to know yourself. Very cliche, right? But I feel like that's what I'm doing. This is all like information that is about myself, because it's about people who look like us or other immigrant communities or folks who have had some similarly difficult times, whatever their marginality. I don't know. I've also found a way to make it more fun. Like when it first started, I remember the head of my department came out to a concert in Providence at the Columbus Theater we were doing. And he, after the show, he was like, "Songs are great, man, but you talk way too much. It's like way too academic-y. Just like start telling stories, you know, but you don't have to put like all the like academic jargon in there."
Julian, thank you so, so much for joining us. This was everything I could have imagined and more. And I'm so grateful for you taking the time.
And thanks for the work that you're doing. And can't wait to listen to more of your music as well.
Thank you so much again to Julian for joining us on the show today. You can find him on Instagram at NoNoBoySongwriter. No No Boy's most recent album, 1975, is available everywhere now. Please subscribe, follow, and rate the podcast on whatever platform you listen. Your engagement really helps us make the show better, believe it or not. And for a small show like us, every little bit helps, so we appreciate it deeply. We love hearing from you. Tell us what you think about the show and who you'd like to hear from in future episodes. You can send us a message on Instagram at goldenhourpod, or you can email us at goldenhour@gmail.com. That's goldenhour@gmail.com. Golden Hour is created by me and produced and edited by Dave Yim. Gabriel Hunter Chang is our production associate. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.